From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in every place where American agents are trying to secure the border. What image comes to your mind when you hear Border Patrol? In a new book called Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, journalist and author Todd Miller shows us that Border Patrol has spread to many cities and states that you would not expect. His book is a wide-ranging examination of American policy and what that policy is creating in the efforts at border control. Miller is going to be coming to the Rochester Finger Lakes area next week for a series of events. We're going to run those down for you as we go throughout the hour. But first, let me welcome journalist and author Todd Miller to Connections. Todd, how are you?
Very good. Thanks a lot for having me.
And you're joining us from sunny Tucson, is that right?
Yeah, very sunny Tucson, Arizona.
Well, and we're going to get to the border in sort of all of its forms as we go throughout this hour, but let me first tell our listeners that this discussion is going to come a lot closer to the Rochester Finger Lakes area than they may expect, not the least of which is because you are from, you grew up not too far from here.
No, I grew up in Niagara Falls, right down the road.
Okay, and so before we get back there, because there are some interesting Border Patrol questions there, and all across our state. Let's start in the Southwest where you are now, because so much of the question of Border Patrol happens there. Let me ask you first, how much travel and time did you have to invest to get a full picture in your mind of what Border Patrol is, Todd?
Oh, wow, yeah, considerable amount. I have been working on these issues or around these issues for a long time, over 10 years. So I had that background as I went into the research of this book. But when I was doing the research, I spent months on the southern border in different border towns, especially in El Paso and Douglas and Nogales on the southern border. And I spent quite a bit of time in the north as well, including Rochester, Buffalo, Niagara Falls, and Detroit, being the principal places. I also went to Puerto Rico, and I spent some time there. I bet probably not many people know that the only sector that the U.S. Border Patrol has that's outside of the mainland United States is in Puerto Rico. So there is actually a U.S. Border Patrol sector 1,000 miles away from the U.S. mainland. So I went there as well. So it took. I spent a good 2 years researching and writing this Border Patrol Nation.
What was the reason that you wanted to tell this story? I mean, in your view, is there a border crisis in this country? Or did you want to find out how the American government is sort of carrying out this policy and who's being impacted? What was the mission?
Probably everything. One significant thing. I've been living in Tucson or southern Arizona since the late 1990s. And when I was living here, I was witnessing actually my first journalistic endeavor, or the first thing I actually got published was a single photograph that I took in 1998 of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and they were building the wall, a border wall between Douglas and Agua Prieta in southern Arizona. And that was because of some operations that were starting to happen in the mid-1990s around that significantly increased and bolstered the kind of border enforcement apparatus. So what I'm trying to say is that throughout my time in southern Arizona particularly, I witnessed the advent of the new kind of border enforcement the new border enforcement practices and actual apparatus, and kind of watched it develop before my eyes. And what you see now compared to what you saw maybe 15 years ago or even 20 years ago, I mean, you just have to look at, say, in 1994, there were 4,000 Border Patrol agents nationwide. It was an agency that, that maybe was more of a federal afterthought than what it is now. Now you see an agency that's about 23,000 agents. It's 5 times the size it was in 1994. And that's unprecedented growth in the last 20 years. Border Patrol was created in 1924, so its growth was very slow from 1924 to 1994. And then all of a sudden you see this explosive growth. And where I live in the Southwest, you just see it all over the place. One thing is the walls. Now when in the mid 1990s they were just beginning to construct a wall. Before that, there was no wall. There was chain link fence between the two countries in urban areas. Now there are 700 miles of walls. The different technologies, the surveillance towers, the concentration of agents. Now, if I go south from Tucson, and we're about 60 miles from the southern border, if I go south from here, I see there's Border Patrol buzzing around everywhere. And most likely, to travel from point A to point B, I will have to pass through at one point a Border Patrol checkpoint where you'll get stopped and asked questions and et cetera, et cetera. So the changes have been very significant. And I think that's one of the things that was motivating the writing of Border Patrol Nation.
Todd, to some degree, isn't that change logical, given that 90 years ago, people were not covering large distances, there was not the advent of transportation and the ease of transportation that there is? I mean, I'm not saying people didn't cover large distances, but hasn't technology and modern living changed a little bit of what we ought to expect when it comes to Border Patrol and control in 90 years?
Yeah, you could definitely look at it along those lines. I mean, at the time, you know, look 100 years ago, the kind of, or even in the 19th century, moving into the 20th century, the kind of long distance immigration that we were seeing was more the kind of settler phenomenon of the United States of this movement from east to west. So you had all kinds of people moving long distances. Most famously with Manifest Destiny and the idea that certain people are able to be a civilizing force and others are not. And that, you know, if you look at the kind of history of how the U.S.-Mexico border was formed, it was formed with a war, right? It was formed with the Mexican-American War, I'm sure we don't have time to go into that, of course. But when you look at, how the origins, the kind of violent origins of the border formation to begin with, there's a lot of people, for example, in the Southwest who say that come from a Mexican heritage or a heritage that comes from, you know, the South. And one of the sayings is that we didn't cross the border crossed us. And people still say that 100 years later. So, but to answer your question, yeah, you were looking at a number of different factors that influence, you know, why, you know, the advent of technologies, one of the big things at first was the Southern Pacific Railroad that crosses through the Southwest, and that looking even at that 19th century creation, and it's still like, you know, chugs by my house every day, the same railroad. When you look at the kind of increase in border enforcement, I think there's a number of different factors that you have to look at. That's one of them. Another is, you know, why there have been people crossing freely through these areas, you know, for thousands of years. If you talk to the Tonawatam people, they've been, you know, traveling through these areas for 1,000 years, and there was no border that crossed their land until 1853. So I don't know. There's a number of ways you can look at it. I mean, certainly you can look at it that way. But one of the things that this kind of advance of technology has done is created an advance in this kind of surveillance technology that's completely concentrated within, you know, the southern southwestern border region. So, as I was saying before, when I go out into the southern borderlands, I mean, I'm going to be on camera. There's possibly a predator-to-read surveillance drone flying overhead. I'm going to have to be stopped at a checkpoint and ask my citizenship. One of the considerable motivations or missions that has pushed a funneling of this considerable or actually unprecedented funneling of resources into border enforcement is the post 9/11 era and what happened after the attacks of 9/11 and the shift from Border Patrol, for example, from the Department of Justice to the Department of Homeland Security. And with that, Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection now have their priority mission is a counterterrorism mission to stop quote-unquote terrorists and quote-unquote weapons of mass destruction from crossing our borders. And when you see that shift, you see this massive increase, unprecedented increase of resources that go into this border enforcement apparatus, including resources for the walls and the technologies and the drones and the more agents and the more guns and the more bullets and so on and so forth. And that itself is probably one of the main reasons that this kind of enforcement apparatus has expanded like it has.
We're talking to Todd Miller, the journalist and author of the new book, Border Patrol Nation. He's going to be coming to the Rochester Finger Lakes area next week for a series of events, including an event next Wednesday at 4:30 in the afternoon at Hobart and William Smith, then 7 p.m. next Wednesday night at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church in Rochester. Again, we're going to run down the schedule of events because there are a bunch coming up here, but Todd's going to be coming here. The book is Border Patrol Nation, and I could choose a lot of potential stories that you tell in this book, Todd. And I must say, I mean, you have been, I wanted to start the conversation by asking you just how far you traveled because it felt like you were everywhere. But let me talk a little bit about kids. And I want to start by asking you about the story that starts with Congressman Sylvester Reyes, who's a Democrat from El Paso, I believe, who grew up, as you write, he grew up as kind of a lookout, he was one of the kids growing up who would be looking out for potential agents.
For Border Patrol.
Border Patrol. And then kind of joined the cause and was a leading kind of funder and person who supported the cause. And what I took from that, first and foremost, was that down there, it seems like everything is painted as black and white. It's either good or evil. You're on this side of the border, you're a citizen. If you're on the other side of the border, you're a criminal. You know, that kind of stark reality seems contrary to what is reality, but that just seems to be the world down there.
Yeah. Well, that is definitely, I would argue, I think you're right, and that's the world that's painted almost elsewhere. You know, this when you hear from Washington, for example, it's almost this world of good and evil, right? Like you're saying, or
right.
The very demarcated boundary line on one side are the good people, on the other side the bad people, on one side the civilized people, on the other side the uncivilized people. On one side, you know, the innocent, and the other side the potential terrorist, right? You could even go to that length. In the case of Sylvester Reyes, who's especially with Border Patrol agents, that's definitely in the border, I would say in the institution of the Border Patrol, that's definitely the kind of like worldview that you almost have to have as an agent because that's the purpose you're supposed to keep.
But I was surprised, Todd, because you have this congressman who grew up understanding that it really isn't that starkly black and white, and then he all of a sudden he joins a federal government that views it in these black and white terms. You'd expect the Sylvester Reyeses of the world to say, look, you know, this isn't a case of if your feet are on this side, you're a criminal, and if your feet are on this side, you're a law-abiding citizen. I mean, it's a little more nuanced than that, but he didn't, at least from what I'm reading.
Yeah, Sylvester is I think you're correct to bring up and these almost incredible what you would consider contradictions, and he's a perfect example of it, and he's just one of many of somebody who grew up in the borderlands. As you said, he comes from immigrant parents, I believe. He looked out for, you know, possible Border Patrol agents as a kid, and then all of a sudden he's in the Border Patrol himself, and all of a sudden he becomes the first Latino sector chief. So in his case, in Reyes' case, he actually found a career path. That's one way to look at it. When you look at, say, a border town, say any border town in the Southwest, you look at the median sort of salaries that people have. Say a teacher makes $20,000 or $25,000 a year in Nogales, for example, and you can start. I mean, it's obvious in Nogales. I was just there. That's why I'm bringing up the Nogales as a border town in Arizona. If you go there, it's obvious who there makes the money, and one group that makes a lot of money compared to everyone else is Border Patrol. it's obvious. They have the nicer houses. They drive the nicer cars. So, like, if you're a kid growing up in Nogales or Douglas or El Paso or anywhere, and you see, you know, your parents are struggling, and then you see, you know, somebody riding around in a nice car, or that they don't, at least superficially, they don't seem to be struggling as much, or they seem to be making a nice salary, that is a draw. That is a draw for somebody like Sylvester Reyes to say, oh, maybe I should join the Border Patrol.
And now you go from Sylvester Reyes as a kid looking out for Border Patrol to getting into Congress. And then kids are now being sort of trained from a very young age, as you write, to follow this career path. But it is, at least from what you reported in Border Patrol Nation, Todd, it is eye-opening just how routine the kids are exposed to kind of an expectation of violence, to how to take somebody down, that even when they were marching in parades, they would show these takedown maneuvers and the crowd would kind of cheer. I mean, that kind of thing is very eye-opening. And kids are now being taught that's life on the border, that, you know, you can grow up and the way to make money is to be an agent, and the agent life is violent, and it's good versus evil.
Yeah, and that's exactly kind of the what I was looking at, especially when writing about, you know, what I was writing about there was the Explorers programs, and people, probably your listeners are familiar with It's a Boy Scout of America's program. And they're called Explorers, and one arm of that is the law enforcement angle. And in the post 9/11 era, that's when you see Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection starting to start their own kind of youth programs. And these are programs for teenagers from 14 to 21 years old. And it's almost like another after school activity. It has that kind of routine normality. You know, they meet once a week during the weekday, and then they'll spend a Saturday, usually the entire day. And when I was doing research, they did a community service project, and other Saturdays though they will work on what you called a takedown, their takedown maneuvers, or how to handcuff people, or how to stop an intruder, quote unquote intruder, from coming through the desert lands, or to how to disarm a terrorist. And they even go to the extent of using what they call red guns, which are fake guns. They're red. They call them red guns because they're red. And so they will do all kinds of different activities. And then the motivation is that they will then be in a competition with other explorer posts. And so every single city and town, large and small, along the southwest border has one of these border patrol sort of posts. So they'll go into competition with each other and see who can handcuff somebody the quickest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In just a moment, I'm going to ask Dr. Lori Gertner, who's the director of the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice, to help lay out Todd's schedule next week if you want to meet Todd and hear him speak and talk to him about Border Patrol Nation. But let me kind of tie up the point on children with this, Todd. So you have this juxtaposition of kids growing up on the border who are being trained in this way, who are living in this world where they're being sort of told it's black and white, it's good and evil, when the reality is now, we've been talking all year about this, the thousands of children coming across the border, the way they're being treated, the questions about whether we instantly deport kids going to Central and Latin American countries and coming from there, trying to escape lives of violence. And when you see it in the context of those kids just trying to survive trips through the desert to get across the border to try to create a new life, you see that it isn't always black and white and good and evil. And I wonder now what your take is on what we're seeing with kids coming across the border and what we've seen so far this year.
Yeah, that's been the story of the year on the southern border. And yeah, they're kids. I mean, that's the first thing. My first initial reaction, I mean, one of the things is that children have been coming across the border for quite a while, of course, and including Central American children primarily from the countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. But this year, of course, the story there was a significant even I think up now there's been 66,000 or almost 70,000 children, unaccompanied minors, who have arrived to the southern border. And the story itself is just quite startling. I mean, you look at the pictures, I'm sure everyone has seen those pictures, you know, of kids in the, during the summer, at least, when they were basically caged in warehouses and different places because there was so much. And you look at them and they're kids, you know. I mean, there's a lot of teenagers, but there's also, you know, kids that are even younger. I saw the classic picture, I think, from the summer for me was this very tall Border Patrol agent in his green uniform kind of filling out his paperwork next to a child who couldn't have been more than 5 years old, who was kind of looking up at the agent expectantly like a five-year-old child should. And at the end of the day, you know, why on earth? I mean, the questions about these children are not, you know, the kind of answers that were being thrown around or still debated over the summer and still now, where, oh, we need to build up our, you know, it was almost this knee-jerk reaction that, oh, we have to build up the border even more. We have to put more money into it. And it seemed like what the fundamental question with the children, especially, you know, thinking about education and thinking about the children in the Explorer programs and the U.S. side, is like, why, you know, why are they have to do this? Why are they in a situation, like a five-year-old's not going to choose to cross a very dangerous journey across the whole country of Mexico, which is super dangerous, to come to the U.S. southern border, which is also super dangerous. A five-year-old should be, you know, barely starting their lives going to nursery school, or a 10-year-old should be, you know, starting elementary school, or a 15-year-old should be in high school. They should be playing with their friends. They should not have to expose themselves to the sorts of danger, nor become a media hot spot, you know, or a hot topic because they're arriving to our border. Because, I mean, there's things to unpack in this, and I don't think we did a good job of doing that.
Well, and I don't know if you saw, but Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy is out with a new paper on this story, and a listener of this program pointed me to it today. And I just want to quote from that and get your take to see if it lines up here. It was co-authored, by the way, by a man who is a research associate at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas's Globalization and Monetary Policy Institute and the Baker Institute's Francois and Edward de Gergen Fellow for Mexico Studies. Okay, so here's what they say. The paper examines historical immigration data, the push and the pull factors currently motivating Mexican and Central Americans to migrate to the United States, and attempts to explain why the current undocumented immigration across the U.S.-Mexico border has been perceived as a crisis. From the paper, quote, in recent months, print and television journalists have presented the American public with a crisis of illegal immigration on the U.S.-Mexico border. Much of the recent discussion is centered on Central American children traveling alone and on allegations that they are responding to motivations created by the Obama administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival policy. The word crisis, however, can have alternative meanings. If a crisis of undocumented immigration means a historically large or rapidly growing flow of undocumented immigrations, the overall national evidence shows today there is no such crisis. And in fact, that the Border Patrol apprehensions of undocumented immigrants attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border have plummeted and remain far below levels a decade earlier. Is that accurate or not, Todd?
Yeah, there are definitely things that are very accurate, and especially in terms of Border Patrol apprehension statistics, which do indicate that there has been. If you look at the number of apprehensions, and I would throw a couple question marks if that's the best way to actually calculate how many people are entering the country. Maybe it's one of the only ways we can look at it. But when people come through the country without documents, it's very hard to count the number of people. Plus, with Border Patrol apprehension rates, with the way that migrant flows work is that they avoid where Border Patrol is. So if Border Patrol is making a lot of arrests in one place, usually the flow will move into even more, you know, isolated, hidden regions. That said, it's clear that the apprehensions have dropped enough that it's clear that clearly that the number of people entering the country has dropped. And so in that sense, yes. In the sense of the word crisis, what we're seeing in the last couple of years, or last, I think, 3 to 4 years, is still a kind of maybe lower but steady immigration coming from Mexico. And I just want to make another point that you see the drop-offs, especially around when the 2008, when there was a number of, you know, there was the trouble, a lot of trouble in the U.S. economy. There was less jobs for people to get once they were in the United States. So you see, like, numbers of undocumented people crossing significantly drop in 2008. And you have a number of reasons why that would be. And, what, you know, if you talk to Border Patrol, they'll say, well, it's because of our enforcement efforts. If you talk to an economist, they'll say, oh, well, you know, there's less jobs for people. So to see why there's less people, that's another kind of interesting aspect of this. However, you know, to go back to the word crisis, yeah, you know, if the way it was being treated in the media, this in, not in all the media, but in some of the media, and the kind of, I would, you know, this kind of sensationalistic reporting that I saw in some places, not everywhere, but it kind of implied that, you know, it implies that the border is being overrun by,
or that this is a new problem, right?
People.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And go ahead.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, it presents it, you know, as this, and that falls quite squarely into this narrative that this very common narrative that, oh, the federal government is neglecting the border. You know, it's porous; people can just come over. And that narrative then lends itself to this, to the growth. You know, that, oh, we need to put more people on the border.
Right.
We need to have the army on the border, the National Guard. We need this, that, and the other thing. And what they don't say is what we were talking about earlier in the discussion, that never before in the history of the United States has there been more Border Patrol agents, more money put towards this, more resources, more walls. The border is not neglected by any means.
Right, and then you have Sheriff Paul Bobeau of Arizona's Pinal County calling for 6,000 soldiers to construct a new double barrier on the Arizona border. He says if more than 400,000 illegals made it into Arizona last year undetected, and Mexican cartels have hundreds of lookouts on Arizona mountaintops to safely escort their drug loads, what do we think is the likelihood of those with military training or a possible terrorist sleeper cell sneaking across? Even though we don't really have evidence of the latter happening, is this a symptom then of this narrative carrying the day, Todd, that, wow, it's the biggest crisis we've ever had, it's worse than it's ever been, we need more people there, we need to spend more money, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly the narrative in action, really. It's Paul Bobeau, the sheriff from Pinal County. It's, you know, it's across the board. You look anywhere, you look at editorials in different, you know, newspapers. Yeah, this narrative is alive and well. One of the things about a situation like the children this summer is that the border, the Southwest border, leaves the kind of national imagination. It's not really, people aren't really thinking about it. And then something like the children happens or something else, right? In this case, the children coming to the border. And all of a sudden, boom, it's like this narrative is all of a sudden, it's there latent the entire time. And it's, and around these parts, you know, you see it with quite regularity. But then all of a sudden on a national level, it just, all of a sudden there's this narrative, and for lack of a better term, it's on steroids. You know, you see it everywhere. It's, everyone's talking about it. Here in the Southwest, we got all of a sudden the media, the kind of media, the different cable news stations, all this that weren't national media outlets that weren't necessarily paying attention to the borderlands before that, all of a sudden are calling left and right, what's going on, what's this, what's that. And then, you know, in like what Paul, your quote that you just read from Paul Bobeau, it's, yeah, that's maybe an extreme version of the narrative, you know, that's an extremer side. But a lot of people do fall into that general narrative, this kind of assumptions about the way things are happening, and And the assumption, the unquestioned assumption, is that we then need to put more money into the border enforcement apparatus. And that's where it always leads.
Talking to Todd Miller, author of Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. It's out now. Let me bring in Dr. Lori Gertner, who is the director of the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice. Lori, how are you?
Fine, Evan. Thank you for having me on.
I
appreciate your having Todd, so hello to both of you.
Well, very good. And Lori, I know it's a busy week with Todd's schedule next week. Give us a sense for how people can participate if they want to hear Todd speak or if they want to meet him and join the conversation.
Yeah, that's great, Evan. First, I'd like to say that this region is very fortunate to have someone with Todd's vision and experience to come to this area and speak to us. But he'll be involved in public talks on three occasions while he's here next week. The first is at St. John Fisher next Tuesday, November 4th. He'll have a public talk on campus at St. John Fisher in Basel 135 from 6:15 to 8:15. At that talk, he'll be mostly talking about his book and how it relates to this community. And then the next day on Wednesday, Hobart and William Smith College is hosting him from 4:30 to 5:30 at the YZ Lounge on Scandling Center on the second floor. And then that Wednesday night, he will be at Downtown United Presbyterian Church, hosted by Rochester Committee on Latin America, for another public talk starting at 7 o'clock. And that one, I think, is going to be very important because he'll be talking about the effects on this region of the dynamics that have occurred, which he's reported on and observed for many years, on the dynamics of the border from the south border of Mexico all the way up to the Canadian border, including the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and all the sides of this issue that he's actually been able to grasp. So this one is going to be a very important talk, which I hope many people from the public can come.
Lori, thanks for taking the time. We'll see you next week, and I'll keep the conversation moving because I'm already seeing I can't get through half of what I'd like to talk about with Todd in this hour. So we'll save a lot of that for next week during his events here. Thanks for taking the time, Lori.
Thank you, Evan.
Lori Gertner is the director of the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice. Let's do this. Let's take a very short break in just a moment. We're going to come back and we're going to bring the conversation closer to home for us and closer to home for journalist Todd Miller. Because as the geographer Matthew Coleman says, and Todd writes in his book, the most significant fallout post 9/11 is the extension of border control to cities and states that really don't have obvious border issues. And we're going to talk about some of that and how it is affecting all of us, as Todd writes in his book, Border Patrol Nation. So more with Todd as we continue right here on member-supported public radio.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Memorial Art Gallery presenting Golden Legacy, 65 Years of Golden Books, featuring original illustration art from American Publishing's picture book series, Little Golden Books, through January 4th. mag.rochester.edu.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. We have author and journalist Todd Miller on the line with us. He's the author of Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. And I want to move the conversation closer here because, Todd, we've been talking about the southwest border, which is obviously a big question of American policy and what's going on there. But you bring us back here to Niagara Falls, and here's a great example here. When you came back for researching in your book, the first time you saw the kind of Border Patrol vehicle in Niagara Falls that you regularly see down there south of Tucson happened at Goat Island. For listeners who are not familiar, describe the scene at Goat Island.
Well, so Goat Island is actually the state park of where right by the Niagara River. It's one of the places where you can You can cross onto Goat Island if you're in Niagara Falls, New York, and there's some just impressive lookouts of the falls, the Horseshoe Falls and the Bridalveil Falls. And it's one of my favorite places, Goat Island. When I grew up, I even have my hiding spots on Goat Island that I used to go to. I'd go take naps in the grass, listening to the Niagara River. And one of the things about it, it's right at the Niagara River, right before at the brink of Niagara Falls. And of course, everyone knows the Niagara River is actually the border between the United States and Canada. So the first time I see the green striped Homeland Security vehicles that I'm so used to seeing in the Southwest and where I live. I mean, so much so that I have it completely associated with, Arizona or Texas or California or New Mexico. And I'm crossing the bridge into Goat Island just to take a break, really. I just want to go and look at the falls and maybe reminisce about my childhood or something. And there, lo and behold, the first thing I see as I cross the bridge is a kind of idling Border Patrol vehicle on Goat Island. It just seemed, I don't know why the Border Patrol vehicle was there. It was just kind of idling there talking to a park police officer. But I looked at it and it's one of those moments where I forget where I am. Where am I? Because I'm so used to seeing such vehicles, but I'm slightly disoriented just by seeing it. I'm like, where am I? And then the other thing is that there's no way anyone's going to cross there, right? It's the rapids, it's the water. It'd be suicidal to jump into that water right there and cross at that point. But there was a Border Patrol agent just kind of idling there in downtown Niagara Falls at the state park right by the beautiful natural wonder of the world.
And you have a conversation with a man named John Atanasio, John Atanasio, retired Border Patrol agent in Niagara Falls, who describes the difference in mentality between when he was working at Border Patrol and now. And you go on to write this, and I want to quote from page 295, Todd. You talk about the fact that Niagara Falls and trust me, here in Rochester, anybody who's been out there knows that the city on the American side is really sort of, it looks rough. I mean, it looks kind of bombed out. You wrote on page 211 of your book that it looks like a city that's already been attacked, as opposed to a place that would be a hot spot for protection. But because of some of the chemical issues and the companies that have been there and the questions on sort of public health, there have been all kinds of issues there. And you write on page 295, it's too bad, to put it mildly, that the rivers of resources and expensive technology that flow into Border Patrol can't be used to protect the city of Niagara Falls from the real and imminent threats posed to people's physical security by corporate contamination, waste, and other love canals in the area. Surely, from up above in the Border Patrol helicopters or drones, they have cameras that can zoom in on the sign on Buffalo Avenue that warns of a bumpy ride due to potholes. And you go on to kind of talk about the fact that from World War II munitions to Hooker Chemical to many others, Niagara Falls is a city that's hurting. And you make the point that with those kind of resources reporting to Border Control, maybe we could really help Niagara Falls. But there are others who have already written in this program today that says, are you minimizing the fact that people can cross the border, and we need to have a semblance of protection, a semblance that we can't just have an open, unprotected border in the modern age of terrorism.
Right. So in this sense, this is where I would argue that this is the discussion. We need a really, really good discussion. And one of the things is, the parts of the discussion is, what is security? What is real security? How are people really threatened? In terms of, is there a really an imminent threat of terrorists crossing our borders? Is it happening? I mean, have there been incidents of this happening? Have people brought weapons of mass destruction across our borders? All this stuff needs to be really, right now you would think that that's the assumption that many people have, that this is what's happening. People are breaching our borders with terrorist intentions when there are, since 9/11, there are no recorded incidences. Now, that's not to say it hasn't happened, but we just don't know about it. But at the same time, usually public relations people are quick to point out, you know, if they catch somebody that has terrorist intentions coming into the United States, that and when you look at Niagara Falls, you know, and one thing I look at, you know, is you know, the housing budget, or one of the things when I return to my hometown and I kind of go around the city, and one of the most distressing things to me is just seeing, you know, derelict homes, places that people used to live, where people that I knew used to live, you know, derelict homes that are collapsing, foreclosed, you know, people losing their homes. And to me, when you think of a house, that is, you know, the cornerstone of a person's security, right? The roof over their head, the place where they can go to sleep at night, you know, the place where they don't have to worry so much about being exposed to some sort of, you know, biophysical harm in any way. And when people are losing homes, to me, that is a security crisis. It's not framed that way in the bigger picture. What we're being told, and this is clearly on the southern border as we discussed, but increasingly more on the northern border as well, that what we have to protect ourselves from something that lurks on the other side of the line, an evil that lurks on the other side of the line, something that's going to come and harm us, something that's going to, you know, attack us. And I'm not saying, you know, that can't be true. That's, you know, that could happen. And you know, maybe there's ways to think about how to think about that. But right now we're putting billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars into this Homeland Security, while at the same time cutting budgets constantly of the most basic services. And one of the most egregious examples to me, just to end this, to end what I'm saying here, is Detroit. In Detroit, their water was cut off for a significant portion of the population within Detroit, a basic service, right? At the same time, in 2011, Border Patrol or Customs and Border Protection opened their first operation, what they call a war room, but they called it operational control room. CBP called it the gold standard of operational control rooms across the country. And this is in Detroit, in the Selfridge Air Force Base, which is just a little bit north of the city. This had a price tag of $30 million. And I think there's a similar one in Grand Island in New York, to the Buffalo sector. And it's super high technologies. There's a big video wall. It takes the feeds from, like, cameras that are looking across the St. Clair River. And there's similar ones probably from the Niagara River and in the Grand Island. They're looking at radar. And, you know, there's a lot of money being put into this idea that we could be, you know, that our security is at risk. When at the same time, it's hard a thing for me to gulp down when I go to my hometown, like you were just mentioning, and I see a place that looks like it's already been bombed.
Todd Miller is the author of Border Patrol Nation. Only got a few minutes left, and Todd, I want to kind of make this point, and it's drawn out in much more detail in the book. But in recent weeks, you know that this country has had a conversation about what some people say is the militarization of police. And you point out in Border Patrol Nation that a lot of that happens under the auspices of Homeland Security and this notion of police departments needing to do anti-terrorism training, anti-terrorism gear with border protection, even if we're not thinking of a place as a natural need for border protection. Fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. That's definitely a phenomenon, and I'm the big story of the summer was Ferguson, and some of those pictures coming out of police forces, and some of them in the Ferguson police, I believe it was, though I'm not sure, but they were getting a Homeland Security grant, right? And then, of course, that funnels in kind of the similar equipment that you see the Border Patrol getting in their case. I think the most famous picture was the police force, you know, driving around in a tank through the streets of Ferguson, and that's a huge argument. One thing that we see on the borderlands often is that and this has been described to me from a person who's very much involved in this. It's a kind of a testing ground or a laboratory for a lot of different technologies and different kind of, you know, even military surplus equipment, or this is the only place up to this point where surveillance drones can fly over the United States, is in the 100-mile zones in the borderlands. And so when you look, police forces, you know, there's a long history of looking at the different aspects of what a police force is and who, you know, and possibly a critique that can last over 100 years. But you can look at the argument of looking at U.S. wars abroad, say in Iraq and Afghanistan. You clearly can see this on the border. And then the kind of transfer of surplus equipment, but not only that, but also ideas of how to, you know, deploy people, how to put forward operating bases. We have these on the border now. How to, you know, this idea of having drones and, you know, it's and radar systems that come from Afghanistan. This idea of this kind of evolution from a war, then being repurposed for a border surveillance thing, and then also moving into the interior of the country and being more kind of a pervasive thing within local police forces as well.
We got time for one phone call, and we've got to get out of here in about 2 minutes with Todd. But Bernard in Fairport, let's keep it tight. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, it's a case of using fear to raise money. My question is, what do Canada and Mexico think about all of this? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bernard. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll answer with Mexico because we only have a second. But Mexico, on one hand, often will protest. They definitely are against the wall. The wall is almost the symbolic. You even have Felipe Calderon, who was the president of Mexico, the previous president of Mexico, actually helped put up, you know, a sign saying tear down this wall or something like that. Like, they're totally against the wall. But yet at the same time, if you look at Mexico, and this is the ultimate contradiction, Mexico also collaborates very deeply with the United States in the sort of border enforcement collaboration. And you see it more on both on the northern border, but you also see it on Mexico's southern border, in which they are working with the United States. They're kind of, the United States is sending resources, the same sort of technologies we see on the southern border. There's this kind of training going on of U.S. Border Patrol agents training Mexican immigration agents, and they are now building up its kind of boundary apparatus, enforcement apparatus with Guatemala and thus Central America. So you see this kind of, you know, you see both sides of the coin. And I think it'd probably be kind of similar with Canada. There's lots of collaboration with Canada, but a lot of Canadians I've talked to are very, you know, look at, you know, the whole kind of buildup of the border with much suspicion and much critique.
Todd, thanks for taking the time. Todd Miller is the author of Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. He is at Hobart and William Smith next Wednesday afternoon. He's in Rochester next Wednesday night. The full schedule you can find with the Greater Rochester Coalition for Immigration Justice, who are helping bring him. And Todd, trust me when I say we barely scratched the surface, so forgive the interviewer, but we'll talk more next week, and thanks for taking the time.
Oh, it was a great interview. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right,
appreciate your questions.
That's Todd Miller. All right, and I thought you'd also want to hear for just about a minute from Carly Fox, and let me bring in Carly Fox, who's an outreach and education paralegal for the Worker Justice Center of New York. Carly, you've got your own event coming up on Sunday, and it's not exactly related to the conversation, but it sort of is. Tell us what's happening on Sunday, Carly.
Thanks, Evan. I think it's really related to the conversation because I think, you know, here in this region, it can feel really far away, the southern border, but because we're a northern border state, there are active immigration border patrol officers really terrorizing the immigrant community that surrounds Rochester. If you've been enjoying the apples, the Honeycrisp apples, and drinking milk and eating Greek yogurt, the folks who are making it possible to have that food at our table are being terrorized by Border Patrol, and unfortunately our state police force is actively collaborating with them, and we've come to call them the Polimigra. And so on Sunday, on Day of the Dead, we're going to come together to deliver a letter to the state police. We're going to come together in SOTUS, New York at 109 West Main Street at 2 o'clock to do a Day of the Dead ritual, and then bring a letter to the state police barracks to say we don't want our taxpayer money, you know, having state police, law enforcement enforcing federal law, and collaborating to the degree which they do with Border Patrol.
All right, so that's Sunday, 2 p.m., Peyton's Marketplace, Patton's Marketplace, and Sotus. Is that right?
That's right.
Carly? That's all right. Carly, thanks for taking the time as well. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Evan.
Carly Fox joining us, and Michelle Faust. I only have about a minute left here. First of all, you helped coordinate the interviews today, and I appreciate that.
Second of all,
we are reaching out to the state police, to the Department of Homeland Security. We want to continue the conversation with their perspectives as well.
Absolutely.
And we expect we'll do that. And in 45 seconds,
okay,
you have been working tirelessly on understanding the Affordable Care Act. What's the update?
We want people to go online. Well, November 15th is open enrollment, and that means you probably have questions. As you prepare for open enrollment, please send us those questions, acawxxi@wxxi.org, and take our survey. You can do that at wxxi.org. Top right-hand corner of the page, press the blue button and take the survey. Thank you.
Well, you can find it right there, and we hope that you will, because Michelle's been doing such a great job of helping answer your questions, and it's an ongoing effort. Thank you, by the way, for the great assistance in helping facilitate this interview this hour.
You got it, dude.
Michelle Faust, my colleague in the WXXI newsroom. And again, by the way, if you couldn't get through or if you want to continue this conversation, Todd Miller's here next week. We're going to continue reaching out to the state police, to immigration. There's a lot more to talk about. This conversation's only getting going. Short break and more with you next on Member-Supported Public Radio.
This program is a production of WXXI.